You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
So what are specific techniques to get more rational? Let's talk to Steven Pinker about it. But also, stay tuned for in a couple of days, I'm also going to release an episode where I test specifically Jay and my wife Robin to see how rational they are. And so that's coming out in a couple of days, but part two is already out today. Knock yourself out. What about something where the metrics are a little harder, like pro-life versus pro-choice? I don't know what you are, but how would you argue the other side against yourself to convince yourself that you were wrong? If you were to argue against yourself, what would the argument be?
Yeah, well, I am a pro-choice, but on the other hand, I would say, you know, unlike most of my, you know, pals, peers, members of my clique, I'm a professor. I live in the People's Republic of Cambridge, although now I'm on sabbatical in the People's Republic of Berkeley, which is even probably even farther to the left. But I do recognize that the arguments that there are arguments that against abortion that we have to take seriously, such as that, well, gee, if it's okay if it's the first 3 months, why isn't it okay after the first 6 months or 8 months or 9 months? What is it? Why isn't it okay for a woman to abort a child the day before she gives birth? And if it is, then why is it not okay the day after she gives birth? Why do we call that infanticide? It's not so easy to come up with a principled reason, and that's why I would not kind of blow off the anti-abortion activists by saying, well, they just want to put women back into the Middle Ages. They want to restrict their reproductive freedom. I mean, it's, you know, some of them probably do. But it's not a trivial issue to say where is the dividing line, and the reason is there is no dividing line. And the argument that I would ultimately make is, since biology doesn't give us a dividing line, the law has to, in the same way we have to, there's no day in which someone transitions from a child to an adult, the law has to be drawn somewhere. And so we say, 18 years old for voting, and 21 years old for drinking, and 16 years old for driving. And we do our best to draw a line in this fuzzy continuum in the case of age. And likewise, when it comes to being a human, there are fuzzy lines. There's no, a fertilized egg doesn't satisfy anyone's idea of a full human. And the question, when does life begin, is an impossible question. I would say it's asking biology to provide something that it can't provide. Therefore, we humans have to figure out what's a line that's going to stand that isn't a slippery slope on the way to infanticide. How do we know it's not a slippery slope, or whether it is or isn't? Well, let's just look at history. We've had Roe v. Wade for 40 years. Has that led to the deadline for abortion creeping later and later so that now there's a lobby for infanticide? Well, no, that has to happen. As it turns out, that the age of viability seems to be reasonably firm, and that's an argument for keeping it there.
And so, okay, that was a very good, presentation of that. So, given that, and given the fuzziness of so many different issues, why do you find that people irrationally hate each other if they don't agree with each other. In many cases, right. Not in all cases. Like, I have friends on both sides of every issue, I think. But so many people, it seems, just hate people who don't agree with the same 50 items that they agree with.
No, it's, and that really is one of the biggest impediments to rationality. It turns out if you ask, you try to find out why do people believe, you know, crazy things like that, that vaccines are dangerous, or that that climate change is a hoax. It has nothing to do with scientific literacy. It is political tribalism. It's, I'm going to believe the people, the things that are identity badges in my political coalition, and I'm going to not believe the ones that the other side don't believe in. And we use the beliefs as signs of loyalty. There is, you know, kind of a tendency in all of us to sort into sects or tribes or clans or coalitions, and to assume that there's competition between them. So what's good for mine is bad for the other. Probably rooted in primitive intervillage warfare when we were before we had the state and courts and police. You think the worst of people who aren't in your social circle. We have managed with the progress of civilization to have bigger and bigger communities, so that we, you know, people in Massachusetts don't go to war with the people in Connecticut.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yes.
If that was in the news every day, like a battle of Concord, Connecticut wins.
Yes, exactly. So it's the fact that we can have, you know, huge groups like that, like the United States of America, and ultimately the globe. We do have the United Nations. We do have, you know, we are the world. People can slip into or out of a kind of global human-wide solidarity. And clearly what we ought to do is promote the species as our ultimate tribe. Now, that's not easy. People slide back into their country, their school, their family. And it's okay to switch back and forth, but when it comes to rights, when it comes to violence, when it comes to treatment, then we really want to expand our moral circle, our moral tribe, so that it encompasses all of humanity.
Right. So on the one hand, active open-mindedness feels like a very much internal effort. Okay, I'm going to recognize when I'm not being open-minded. Perhaps I'm feeling anger or resentment to somebody who is believes something. So maybe that's triggering me that I am not as open-minded as I think I am. But it seems like also there's external factors as well, as you mentioned, like what sex am I? What political group am I in? What location am I in? What kind of level of education do I have? Like, how do we, that's a lot of different biases. The list goes on of different groups and subgroups that we're in. So that's a lot of different potential ways to affect our thinking. How can we kind of step out of all that tribalism at the micro and macro level, given that we're tribal animals?
Yes, well, like all of our instincts, they coexist with each other and with a frontal lobes system too, as Kahneman calls it, reflective reasoning. So we can try to push back on some of our deplorable instincts if we recognize that they're not good things to indulge. That's part of the answer. But the other part of the answer is that none of us is virtuous enough to do that just by sheer goodness or willpower. We've got to set up institutions like democracy, like science, like journalism, where the rules are that you don't get ahead by indulging in tribalism, in magical thinking, in wishful thinking, in arguing from authority. The rules are that you gain points, you get your way if you've presented persuasive arguments. Now, it's the reason that that's not a pipe dream is, yeah, I want to win arguments, but at the same time, I don't want you to win arguments. I don't want some, you know, other guy to win arguments if he's wrong. If you then say, well, we all of us together want to win arguments, so who wins? And we say, okay, well, if I say it's always going to be me, well, I'm not going to get you to agree to that. What will we all agree to? Well, we can all agree, whoever has the best argument, whoever's got the evidence, that guy wins, or gal. And we can therefore set up debating rules, or deliberation rules, voting rules, publication rules that are more virtuous than any of us could be if we were acting alone. And we all join the club that follows those rules, because that's kind of our only choice. And, you know, unless we're so, you know, dominant, powerful, macho that you can just impose your way by force, if you want to join a community, you got to follow its rules, and you got to set up the rules so that the winner of the argument is the one with the best argument.
And so you've worked in academic institutions, most notably you're a professor at Harvard. There's lots of instances, I don't know if this has happened at Harvard, where if someone says something, and you've been through this a little bit in different groups you've been in, but if you say something or write something 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and some people don't like what you wrote, it's almost a new thing now where people are getting fired over...
Offense archaeology. You dig down for something that offends you. And
I've never heard that phrase. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, offense archaeology and cancel culture. Yeah, these are exact. Well, these are precisely the opposite of the of rules of the game that foster truth and accuracy. They're ways of punishing unpopular beliefs, of intimidating people who might disagree with the current consensus. And so that would be, these are all steps in the wrong direction, and ought to be, you know, called out and opposed.
Yeah, so is there a line there? Like, for instance, let's say I'm a professor of English, and I firmly believe, and I write scholarly articles, and I firmly believe that the world is flat. At what point should I be fired?
Well, you should probably not have gotten the job in the first place, just because you're, given that the world isn't flat, and that's something we can say with a pretty good, strong degree of confidence, it's very unlikely that you would have mustered a good argument that the world is flat. So it's not that some things are within the realm of reasonable disagreement, in the sense that the evidence is ambiguous enough that intelligent people can offer competing arguments. In the 21st century, the argument that the world is flat is going to really not going to pass muster.
All right, let's take something a little fuzzier. Like, let's say I argue that a baby, it's okay to have an abortion an hour before birth is scheduled. And a lot of people are offended by, I'm an English professor, I have no expertise in this, and a lot of people are offended and are calling for me to be fired. Certainly there are much smaller offenses that people have been fired for. So I'm just curious, like, where the line in this has been, perhaps, you know, people have stepped, you know, institutions have stepped over the line in this, where academics who are encouraged to be, you know, skeptics or at least free thinkers are being squashed a little bit. And it happens in academia, but it happens in every industry now.
Yeah, no, it's a genuine problem. And if it is not resolved, then it's a recipe for error. We're going to believe a lot of false things if people are not allowed to disagree without fear of losing their job. At the same time, you have to make,
because sometimes the minority is sometimes the majority is wrong.
Yeah, sometimes the majority is wrong. A lot of the time, because that's how knowledge grows. Not everything that we believe is right, and almost by definition, if we learn something, it's because someone points something out that disagrees with the current consensus. That's why you need freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of inquiry. Otherwise, we are going to be locked into mistakes. And we're in danger of that if we have a regime where, if you disagree with the majority, you get punished. That having been said, you do have to make distinctions on the basis of quality, such as we don't have to give tenure to the professor of geophysics who argues for a flat Earth. Almost certainly, I don't know, maybe we're all wrong. Maybe the Earth is flat. Probably not. And you can't spend all of your time debating every hypothesis, no matter how crazy. You've got to have the goods, have an argument, and it's perfectly legitimate not to hire a flat Earth geologist, especially if the only thing that he has going for him is scripture or totally bogus arguments, like that the window of the airplane distorts the view and makes it look like the Earth is curved. You can show that that's just wrong. And granted, they're gray areas. Sometimes the problem is that in a lot of cases, people do dismiss arguments by saying that they don't stand up to intellectual quality, whereas in reality, they just don't like the conclusion. So you've got to expose that and say, well, hey, there actually is nothing wrong with this argument other than the fact that you don't like the conclusion, so you shouldn't use that to suppress this guy. But the ideal, the aspiration is you allow in arguments that have been defended according to the rules that promote truth, such as fact-checking, such as surviving peer review, such as submitting themselves to empirical tests that turn out the right way, such as consistency with what data that we have, realizing that nothing is ever a guarantee, because none of us are angels. We might get locked into wrong beliefs, but to try to set up the rules of arguing and hiring and promoting so that we don't get locked into false beliefs, so that if something that we believe is wrong, there will be a way for someone to show it.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers, and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles.
Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
I don't know if you made the connection directly in the book, but it's implied. Rationality is very much linked to creativity. Because if you're truly rational, you're aware of things like cognitive biases and of probability and so on. So you're aware that, like you just said, sometimes you might be wrong or that we don't know everything. So when, as an example, when Picasso comes out with cubism, he's basically saying, and other people are saying, that's not art, it's not a picture of anything. He's basically saying that, well, you can represent things in other ways than purely realistic. This is another way of representing things. And so he stays within the current framework, but expands the definition of it so that his paintings are still rational within that framework. And it seems like that's underlies rationality, that you pick a framework, but you're able, it's a broad enough one that you're able to tweak it and expand the definition of it in ways that are acceptable so that you could then come up with something new. So that, like you say, the majority is not always right. In fact, it's often wrong. And the minority can have a voice if we understand rationality.
Yeah, I think that's right, and there is a sense in which even artists, even the most creative artists, set themselves goals and use their rational faculties to attain those goals. And sometimes the goal is expand the boundaries of the current genre of art. How do I come up with something that people will still recognize as art, but different from what they're used to? And that boundary can change, and people, very smart people, can try to figure out how to change it.
Yeah, so again, I wonder, given the importance of rationality and given the basic framework, like understanding logic, understanding probability, understanding your cognitive biases, understanding the effect of the groups around you have on you, again, I wonder, other than active open-mindedness and maybe identifying the groups you're in and that you succumb to occasionally in your thinking, what are other ways to exercise my rationality muscle?
Yeah.
I would add also that getting 8 hours of sleep, oddly, will make you more rational.
Well, that's true. And that is certainly just sheer, you know, brain power, having a brain that works well. Some of us are born smarter than others, but all of us can make ourselves smarter by, you know, nourishing ourselves well and exercising and getting a good night's sleep so that at least the brain is working at full capacity. That's not enough to guarantee rationality, because you could apply your brain power to dubious goals, like just winning an argument regardless of whether you're right or not. But I think part of the answer is you should cultivate active open-mindedness as a virtue. And none of us are perfect, none of us are angels, but we do try to become better, and that's one of the ways in which we can try to become better. Number two, we should learn, be become aware of the tools of rationality that have been invented over the centuries, and that's what I try to do in a gentle way in rationality. I have chapters on tools of thinking like logic and probability and correlation and causation and rational choice theory. And the third is that we should implement rules in our communities of discourse, our workplace, our journalistic institutions, in academia, in our clubs, in our debates, where the rules reward virtues like supporting arguments with evidence, not appealing to authority, not insulting someone as a way of refuting their arguments, and so on. They should be a kind of part of our everyday etiquette, in the same way that we no longer make ethnic jokes or gay jokes the way people did when I was a kid. We don't smoke in public enclosed spaces and as we used to. So just sort of norms and etiquette can change. And whenever we join an actual institution, like a university, like a newspaper, like a parliament, then those rules should be implemented that you can't just shout someone down, you can't just shut them up, you are responsible for supporting your arguments with evidence, and so on.
You know, you mentioned probability and logic, and these things aren't really taught in grade school, let's say first through 12th grade. Instead, we learn in math, at least in trigonometry, goes into, you know, algebra goes into geometry, trigonometry, calculus one, calculus two, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you think, like, it seems like all through school, even much of college, we're just absorbing information instead of discovering new things. So, like, why don't you think statistics or probability are taught, or more philosophical ways of thinking as opposed to specific ways of thinking?
It's a really good question, and it's actually been decades since scientists and scientific thinkers have called for probability to be a part of the curriculum. H.G. Wells made that argument back in the 1940s, and you really can't defend, if there are only so many hours in the school day, the idea of teaching trigonometry instead of probability is just insane. I have nothing against trigonometry. I've used trigonometry in my work and in my life. All things being equal, it's better to know trigonometry than not know trigonometry. But on the other hand, you can't know everything. And if you're going to prioritize knowledge, as you must, then one should have arguments as to what is more fundamental. And certainly probability, critical thinking, logic, even spotting cognitive fallacies to avoid them, seems to me pretty foundational in the sense that lots of other things depend on it. Just as, you know, why do you teach reading and writing? Well, it's kind of obvious why that's one of the first things you teach, namely without those, you can't learn anything else. And the same argument can be made for some of the tools of critical thinking. That is, you can't really understand history or politics or economics without some sense of probability, which includes, as all education should include, should not just be showing people the right way to do things and giving them tools, but also why they need them, namely, left to your own devices. Here are some fallacies that you're going to slip into. This little trick, this little formula, is a way that you can climb out of that that limitation, that fallacy, that bias. I mean, it's always better to know why you need something, such as what kind of blunders will you make if you don't have it.
So, given that in our society, you know, there's a lot of intelligent people. You've written all these amazing books. I think it was in 2004 you were listed in the Time magazine, had you the one of the 100 most influential people around. Which, by the way, I love these lists, even if they don't mean much. But what, right. What did you think when they called you and said you're one of the 100 most influential people on the planet? What did you think to yourself?
I'm human. I was delighted. It was a nice, a lot of nice, not so nice things happen to each of us every day. So I certainly savor the rare moments when something good happens.
So let's say you were transported to the year 912 AD in England. So that everyone's speaking rough English. You could roughly understand people. How would you avoid getting killed? Like, what value would you bring, given all of your knowledge and intelligence and everything you've done? what would you do to help out society and to survive? Because first, people would be skeptical of you. What would you do if you were just suddenly teleported to 912 AD?
I mean, just as a practical matter, just thinking, oh my God, here I am in the Middle Ages. I got to deal with it. What am I?
Prove yourself.
Well, 912 AD, my God.
So you can't predict the future, because I have no idea what happened in like 915 AD or anything like that.
Right. You know, I suspect I might have gravitated toward the church, just because that's where the illiterate people ended up.
That's good. No one's given that answer.
Yeah, right. Not that I, you know, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in, you know, God or in following religious dogma. But given the world, you know, what will be the opportunities for someone who likes to think, someone who likes to read? Back then, there weren't a whole lot of opportunities. There weren't a whole lot of universities, if any. Probably not. I think the first one in Bologna came even later than the 10th century. So to make do, there certainly were philosophical thinkers, and they weren't, I guess they weren't all associated with churches. I would look for a niche of, I don't know how you can make a living as a thinker back in the 10th century.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you can, or if you have to just be like a knight or something, or you have to know how to make shoes. But anyway, Steven Pinker, I really enjoyed the book. I'm going to read the title again. I like the subtitle as well. Rationality, what it is, why it seems scarce, and why it matters. And it definitely matters. We've seen it most of all. Again, I say this past year, but probably every year they say this past year was the most important year ever. So probably rationality has always been as important as it was this past year. I really do agree that reading this could help you understand how to face the issues in your life a lot better. Just thinking rationally, being more open-minded, understanding all the concepts you talk about and you present in a very step-by-step fashion. I think someone should make almost a rationality workbook. Like, I love the puzzles you have almost throughout the book, but particularly in the beginning where, you know, majority of people don't really get these answers right for various reasons. And you could get deeper and deeper. Like, you could almost make a workbook where you have very pivotal issues and encourage people to write strong arguments on both sides, and not just logic puzzles or probability puzzles or game theory puzzles, but then some of these more difficult active open-mindedness puzzles to exercise the rationality muscle. But anyway, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I love all your books. People should not only read this one, please read The Better Angels of Our Nature. Read all your books, but The Better Angels of Our Nature, Enlightenment Now. These are such important books to read to understand society and history in general. And once again, Steven, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
It's been great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.